A couple of weeks ago, I spoke on the subject, how to protest properly, from the book of Esther. And the title of that sermon ended with part one, indicating there would be a part two. And that's where we are this morning. Our message this morning is going to be from Esther chapters 7 and 8. Now, we're going to cover a lot of ground this morning. We're not going to delve into every verse in detail, but rather capture what is going on, because unfortunately, where chapter 8 begins is a chapter break that breaks the flow of the story where it shouldn't be. So we're actually going to combine these two chapters this morning. Now remember, back in chapter 5, Esther had risked her life by appearing before King Xerxes uninvited. That was something you did not do in the ancient Persian Empire. You could lose your life. But she knew that, and she appeared before the king, and he extended the gold scepter, which was his way of saying, it's okay, you can come, you can approach the throne. The king asked her, what is it that you want? I'm sure in his mind he's thinking, this must be really important for Esther to break protocol, to just appear uninvited, knowing that it could mean her life. This must be really important to her. And he must have been shocked when what Esther said was, I would like you and Haman to attend a banquet that I'm fixing for today. King thought, okay, if that's what you want, we'll come. And so Esther hosted a banquet. The king, Xerxes, and Haman, who at this time you might, some call them the prime minister, vice king, whatever you want to call him, that's what he was. And they have this banquet. We get to the end of the banquet, and I'm sure that the king's mind is just spinning. What could it possibly be that Esther wants? And so he asks her again, what is it that you want? And she says, if I please you, come back tomorrow for another banquet I'll prepare for you in Haman. At this point, she has got to be driving her husband nuts. Just stringing him along. And we saw how the previous night, the king couldn't sleep. I had suggested maybe he couldn't sleep because he was wondering what Esther was up to. What is this so important thing that she would risk her life for, and yet she won't tell me what it is? So now the time has come. In chapter 7, we read about the second banquet. And it is the time Esther will speak. See, there are times in our lives when we need to stand up for what's right, regardless of the consequences. And as I mentioned in that earlier message, how we go about that can be as important as what we are standing against. We can have a legitimate complaint, but if we protest illegitimately, we lose the force of what we're trying to say. We lose our cause. It's invalidated. And so we're going to look here in Esther chapter 7 and go into chapter 8. We're going to find three lessons we can learn that as we take a stand in our community and in our culture against what is wrong, we can do so correctly. We can protest properly according to Scripture. The first lesson is this. Don't be primarily passionate. What I mean by that is, don't let your emotions overtake you. Now, that's hard to do. If we really feel strongly against something and we have an opportunity to speak out, our emotions have a way of getting the better of us sometimes, don't they? How many of us have spoken in an emotional rush and then we later regret what we said? Whole lot of us can attest to that. Now, for Esther, she had to be very, very careful about what she said. And not just what she said, but how she said it. We begin in verse 1 of chapter 7. So the king and Haman went to dine with Queen Esther. And as they were drinking wine on the second day, the king asked again, "Queen Esther, what is your petition? It will be given you. What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be granted." Now, this isn't the first time Esther has heard these words. In fact, it's the third. She heard them the first time when she approached the king. She heard them after the first banquet. Now, for the third time, after the second banquet, he's saying, "Whatever you want, Esther, just say it. Tell me what it is that you want." See, Esther was very wise. I think that for most of us, in the heat of the emotion of the moment, we might have spurted something out the very first opportunity we got. And the king's heart would not have been ready. I don't know how Esther knew to wait, but she did. She had a sensitive heart. She was listening to God's moving. And he had said, "Wait," and she waited. Now, there's a difference here. Even though the wording is very, very similar to what the king had said on these other two occasions, there's one difference, and that is how he addresses her. Do you notice there it says, "Queen Esther"? Before, he just referred to her by her name. Now he's adding the title. And this is very important, because it is a recognition that she is just not some ordinary subject. She is in a position to speak. She is in a position to be heard because she is the queen. She is the one whom he selected out of all the women of the Persian Empire to be his wife. And I'm sure that must have been very encouraging to her, hearing that he is addressing her as the queen. Now, Esther had to choose her words very carefully. Sometimes we don't do that, and it can be a nuisance when we're ineffective in our communication. We have to explain ourselves. Sometimes it causes misunderstandings that causes a big mess. Well, here, Esther's life and the lives of her countrymen were on the line. And she had to be very careful in what she said and how she said it, because she had to persuade this Gentile king to reverse course and save the Jewish people. If she alienated her audience, which at this point is the king, she could guarantee the death of the Jews, including herself. But instead of allowing her motions to get the best of her, Esther answers in verses 3 and 4. "If I have found favor with you, O king, and if it pleases your majesty, grant me my life. That is my petition. And spare my people. That is my request. For I and my people have been sold for destruction and slaughter and annihilation. If we had been merely sold as male and female slaves, I would have kept quiet, because no such distress would justify disturbing the king." Now, we may not catch it as we read words on a page, but there is an awful lot of sensitivity, there's an awful lot of diplomacy in what Esther says here. Notice how she begins with respect for the king. "If I have found favor with you, if it pleases your majesty." Not condescending, not speaking down to. I mean, that's something we often do when we disagree with somebody, right? If we are in a discussion, I won't say argument, but sometimes it can become that, and the other person just doesn't see things our way, they just must not be very smart, right? And that can come across in how we address them, how we speak to them. Esther doesn't do that. She shows respect. She actually repeats back to the king the phrases he uses. "What is your petition? What is your request?" And she says, "Spare my life. That's my petition. Spare my people. That's my request." She wasn't overstepping her boundaries, because she was answering the king's question. Now, she does say, "My people have been sold for destruction and slaughter and annihilation." Now, that might sound like she's going a little overboard. I mean, really? But you know, those are the exact words used in Haman's edict. This was no emotional outburst. This was not an exaggerated claim. These were the exact words that were used in the edict. And furthermore, by using the passive tense here, she says that her people have been sold. She's not pointing an accusing finger at the king, even though it was the king's seal that was on the edict. Yes, it's true, Haman wrote the law, and the king gave Haman the signet to seal it, but it still had the king's seal. Technically, he was responsible for that edict, but she doesn't throw that in his face. She doesn't say, look what you've done. Everything she says and how she says it, very diplomatic, very tactful, very respectful. And if I might say at this point, that is a lesson a lot of Christians need to learn. Some of the most tactless and rude people I've ever met claim to be Christians. And when they approach people, and maybe they are standing up for against something that's wrong, either in culture or in that person's life, how they go about it might turn them further away than it does bring them to Christ. I think we need to learn lessons in respect, in good communication. And a lot of that has to do with keeping our emotions in check, not being primarily passionate. I know a lot of people say, let your heart be your guide. That is a bad idea. You let your emotions guide you, and boy, you're going to regret it more often than not. Esther was very careful. I think she really planned everything she was going to say here. One scholar commends her brief but skillful reply. She uses an economy of words to get her message across. She shows that she was listening. When she repeated back the king's own words, she shows she was listening to him. How good are we at listening? If we're talking to somebody, if we're debating a point, how good are we at really listening at what the other person has to say? Or are we so determined to get our point across that we don't even bother? Christians oftentimes say, Christ is the answer. I agree with that. Yes, he is. But I also think we need to stop and listen long enough to find out what their questions are before we give them the answer. It's very important how we say what we say. Esther's approach was bold, yet tactful. Her words were plain, yet powerful. Her request was direct, yet non-incriminating. By controlling her emotions, Esther controlled her encounter with the king. But if we let our emotions get away from us, we lose control. And we often find ourselves on the outside looking in. She said no more than was necessary to accomplish her goals, and she said it very carefully, very clearly. And I think we need to exercise those same skills. Now, God gave you a mind. God gave you reason. God gave you a unique sensitivity. It's built right into your spiritual system. Each person is tuned a little differently. But God wants to reveal to you and through you his will. He wants to teach you while you are waiting. So like Esther, don't rush into big decisions. And may I be painfully direct, don't talk so much. Believers who are growing up not only respect God's silence, they model it as well. Secondly, don't be particularly personal. Pick up the story here in verse 5 of Esther 7. King Xerxes asked Queen Esther, who is he? Where is the man who has dared to do such a thing? Esther said, the adversary and enemy is this vile Haman. Then Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. The king got up in a rage, left his wine, and went out to the palace garden. But Haman, realizing the king had already decided his fate, stayed behind to beg Queen Esther for his life. Just as the king returned from the palace garden to the banquet hall, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was reclining. Understand that in those days, they didn't sit at tables in chairs to eat. They would recline. Now, common people would just recline on the floor. They'd prop themselves on their left elbow and eat with their right hand, usually. All those pictures of Jesus and the disciples at the Last Supper, nah, didn't happen that way. And here you have a palace of a king, so instead of lying on the floor, they had couches, make it more comfortable. They had tables, kind of like our coffee tables, they wouldn't be quite as high, that the food would be on. Esther is reclining, probably laying on her side. And Haman throws himself at her feet, probably, it says here, on the couch. He is so desperate for his life to be spared. And what he does here is he breaches the protocol of the Persian culture. See, back then, number one, you were not to be left alone with another man's wife or a member of the harem. So technically, when the king got up and left, he should have gone up and left also. But he thought his only chance was for the queen to spare his life. Not only that, if you were to address a woman, particularly in the king's harem, you could not get any closer than 7 steps from her. And he was, as we would say it today, all over her. So when the king comes back from his garden, maybe having cooled off that much, this is what he sees. And his first thought is, are you kidding me? Is he really going to try to assault her right in front of my eyes? Now, we know that's not what Haman was doing. But do you see how the tables have been turned? Earlier in the story, Haman could do no wrong. Mordecai could do no right. Now, Haman can't do anything right. Even what Haman tries to do turns around on him. I mentioned last week how Haman, to me, is just like that cartoon figure, Wile E. Coyote. You know, he's always got the elaborate schemes to get the Roadrunner, and it always falls back on him. Here you see the ultimate of that. Because as the king walks in and sees this, and he even says, will he dare molest the queen while I'm still in the house? The bodyguards around him immediately take their cue, and it says they covered Haman's face. They put something over his head. That was a sign back then that you're dead meat. The king didn't even have to say, execute this man. They already knew it. I think that probably gives you a little inkling as to what the people felt about Haman. They couldn't wait to get rid of this guy. In fact, one of the bodyguards speaks up. His name was Harbona, one of the eunuchs attending the king. He says, by the way, sire, I happened to notice on my way to work this morning that there's a gallows 75 feet high right outside of Haman's house. And I hear that he planned on hanging Mordecai on it. You know, the guy that saved your life. It'd be a real shame for that not to be used. And King says, what a great idea. Hang him on it. And they took Haman out and he was executed. And then we're told the king's fury subsided. Now, we might look at that and think, Esther really was kind of making it personal, wasn't it? I mean, you know, she did point the finger at Haman and even called him vile, wicked, whichever translation you're using. That sounds kind of personal to me. And if this were the end of the story, I might agree with you. But this is where that chapter division does us no service. See, this is the end of chapter 7. I would imagine most preachers would just close the book at this point and say, that's it. Haman fell into his own trap, and that's the lesson of the story. But that's not the end of the story. We need to keep going. So move on with me down to chapter 8. That same day, King Xerxes gave Queen Esther the estate of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came into the presence of the king, for Esther had told him that he was related to her. The king took off his signet ring, which he had reclaimed from Haman, and presented it to Mordecai. And Esther appointed him over Haman's estate. And they lived happily ever after. No, that's not what it says, is it? In fact, what it says is, Esther again pleaded with the king, falling at his feet and weeping. You're thinking, what now? That's probably what the king was thinking. You've got to be kidding me. I just hanged Haman. I just gave you his whole estate. Now what? And what she says is this. If it pleases the king, if he regards me with favor and thinks it is the right thing to do, if he's pleased with me, let an order be written overruling the dispatches that Haman devised and wrote to destroy the Jews and all the king's provinces. Now listen to this. For how can I bear to see disaster fall on my people? How can I bear to see the destruction of my family? See, at this point, I think we could pretty well assume Esther is safe. Yes, now the king knows that she's Jewish. The king now knows that Mordecai is her relative. And Mordecai has been promoted to the place Haman was. So they're set. And I'm sure that the king would not let anything happen to them personally. But though Haman was dead, his edict was not. It was very much alive and threatening. Esther could see beyond her own personal world into the world of people who were still at risk. People whose lives were still in the balance. See, it had been very easy to Esther say, well, okay, I'm taken care of. Whew, that was close. Oh, now I can rest easy. No. Because there were an estimated 15 million Jews in the Persian Empire at that time. Out of a total of 100 million people. That's a pretty small minority. And 9 months from now, they could be annihilated. Legally. And Esther says, I can't bear to watch that. I cannot sit by, even though I'm safe, I can't sit by and allow that to take place. So she speaks up again. I think she's very similar to Paul at this point. Paul writes in Romans 10:1, Brethren, my heart's desire, we might say the burning passion of my heart, is prayer, and my prayer to God is that Israel would be saved. He says later on, I would be willing to trade in my salvation if they could be saved. That's compassion. To trade your place in heaven and let somebody take it, whew, that's really concern. And it's that same kind of concern Esther has for her people. See, to stop short here would be to selfishly accept personal deliverance without proper concern for everybody else. And again, Christians, we need to be careful here. It's easy for us to say, I'm saved. I'm washed in the blood of the Lamb. My name is written in the book of life. I'm looking forward to heaven. And all that's true. So I don't have to worry about anything else. That's not true. We are here to make a difference. Jesus said, you are the light of the world. You are the salt of the earth. And it ought to bother us that there are people out there who are dying and going to hell because they don't know Jesus as we do. Does that keep us up at night? Does that cause grief in our heart? Or are we just so satisfied that we're saved? Yeah. Oh, well, that's on them. This is what I mean by don't make this particularly personal. See, Haman wasn't the enemy. Haman was gone, but the threat was still there. And it's easy for us, if we see an evil happening in our society, to identify it with a person and see, they're the problem. And if I can get rid of them, the problem goes away. It doesn't work that way. Because people are not the problem. Paul writes in Ephesians 6:10, and I like the way J.B. Phillips renders this, for our fight is not against any physical enemy. It is against organizations and powers that are spiritual. We are up against the unseen power that controls the dark world and spiritual agents from the very headquarters of evil. The atheists out there are not the enemy. The abortionists out there are not the enemy. Whoever else you want to talk about, ISIS, the terrorists, they are not the enemy. If anything, they are hostages being held captive by spiritual forces of evil. That is the enemy. And I want you to imagine yourself for a moment that you are on a rescue team and you have been given an automatic weapon and you're told, we're going to charge into this place and rescue the hostages. Do you bust through the door and just gun down everybody you see? I hope not. If so, I wouldn't want to be one of the hostages. The idea is you get the bad guys and you bring the good people, the innocent lives, out. But I wonder sometimes if, especially we as Christians, just go in with guns blazing and blow away everybody we see. Because you're doing wrong, you're committing sin, you're doing what's evil. Yeah, that's true. But it is not our place to judge them. It's not our place to annihilate them. It is our place to win them. And you don't do that by being argumentative. You don't do that by being aggressive. You don't do that by being violent. Our weapon in this warfare is love. And Jesus said, love your enemies. Bless them that persecute you. Pray for those who despitefully use you. We're not called to fight them. We're called to fight the powers behind them. Don't make it personal, because they're not the enemy. Keep it in the realm in which it's meant to be. This is how we can hate sin and still love the sinner. Our protest should always be against the principle of wrong, not the people committing the wrong. And then finally, to protest properly, do be positively practical. Now, we're not going to read the entire chapter 8, but you find that the king and the queen and Mordecai get together and they come up with a creative solution. You see, they couldn't simply repeal Haman's law because there was a thing about the laws of the Medes and Persians that could not be rescinded. So they had to get creative. And what they did is they wrote another law, which said that now the Jews on that day can assemble themselves, because there's strength in numbers. They can arm themselves, and they can defend themselves. Apparently, in Haman's law, they couldn't do that. So it was a way of addressing the problem in a positive way. And I think we need to start thinking along those lines in our own culture. See, we don't live in a Christian society. That might be news to you. We don't. This is not a Christian nation. Some would argue it never was. I'll let them argue that. Right now, we're not. Our nation is as pagan as the Persian Empire that we're reading about in Esther. And frankly, the government is getting about as against Christians as they were against the Jews. And I think that's going to get worse. So what are we going to do about it? Well, we need to be positively practical. We need to be creative. We need to address the problems not just by protesting what's wrong, but by promoting what's right. Let me give you an example. Back in the 1980s, a very prominent minister was very outspoken against abortion. He was known throughout the country for his stand against the murder of unborn children. But a reporter approached him one day and said, well, let me ask you something. What are you doing to help those pregnant girls that aren't married, that are kicked out of their homes, that are ostracized, have no place to turn. What are you doing about them? And in his own words, it stopped him in his tracks. Because he wasn't doing a thing. And he never even thought about it. All he was doing was protesting what was wrong. And that very year, he started a home. It was initially called Save a Baby. It was a place where these pregnant girls could come. There was a safe, supportive environment. They were given options. They didn't have to kill their child. If they didn't want to keep it, they could put it up for adoption. There were other things that could be done. Later on, he established the Family Life Services, which was a private adoption agency to place the babies that weren't aborted. See, it's one thing to curse the darkness. It's another thing to light a candle. It's another thing to stand for what's right. See, anybody can criticize the wrongs. There's plenty of those to choose from. We need to go beyond the wrong. We need to be positively practical. That's going to take creativity. That's going to take guts. It's going to take the willingness to be part of the solution. Now, the temptation here is to say, that's not my problem. It doesn't affect me. I'm not going to get involved. Let me read to you the testimony of a Martin Niemöller. He was a popular preacher in Germany back in the 1930s as the Nazis took over. He was eventually arrested and sent to a concentration camp. And this is what he writes. In Germany, they first came for the communists, but I didn't speak up because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the Jews. I didn't speak up because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Catholics, and I didn't speak up because I was a Protestant. Then they came for me, and by that time, no one was left to speak up.